Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 28, 2008. We'll be on live from 3 to 4 in the afternoon, Eastern Time, United States, on the Internet for Executive Intelligence Review News Service, which those of you participating live know is LaRouchePub.com, www.LaRouchePub.com. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm with the economics section and will be the host this afternoon for the discussion whose topic you have seen on our website is, will your bank still be open at the end of the quarter? Now, in case some of you have been in a blur or under a rock, you know, the end of the quarter, the second quarter this year, is 36 hours from now. And the question isn't even facetious at the rate things in the financial system are blowing apart. It's beyond declaring losses when it comes to banks and other entities. You could say we're in a kind of chaos phase shift where the collapse system is creating more chaos, even to the point where basic economic functions are either shutting down or in danger of doing so. That is, impossible to pay fuel bills, food bills, and we've not had any intervention to create an emergency response or for a new system that would restart and serve economies and nations. So, in other words, I guess you could say we still have loonies at the control panel here. But let me just say the following and then introduce our guests, because it was only about a year ago, minus a few weeks, it was July 25, 2007, when Lyndon LaRouche gave an international webcast based in Washington, D.C., to warn and to state that the financial system was gone. It was collapsing, and this was terminal. This wasn't a dip or a depression. And so now we've come all that year since that time, and I will say right now, July 22nd, please note, July 22nd this year at 1 p.m. Eastern Time in the United States, Mr. LaRouche will give another webcast on the situation, and in particular, within the next few hours, maybe 24 to 30 hours, will be posted a new paper on what to do about the situation. It's a proposal by him, and it's occasioned by the debate going on in Russia about various things they are or are not doing on economic policy, but Mr. LaRouche is addressing the potential for the world to get out of this mess if Russia, India, China, and the United States band together to do certain emergency things for the financial system, for credit, for real economic needs. So watch for that in the next 24 to 36 hours being posted on websites, especially his Political Action Committee, LPAC, LaRouche Political Action Committee. And so with that, let me just say, to discuss this this strategic situation, we're very glad to have John Hofel on the line, our economics chief. Hi, John.
Hi, Marcia.
And he's near our studio, but from the West Coast, the Pacific Coast out in Seattle, from the LaRouche Youth Movement there in the Northwest, we welcome Stuart Battle. Hi, Stuart.
Hello.
And you can imagine what John may talk, well, you never know what John's going to talk about, but I know Stuart especially has been part of leading the charge on the West Coast with the population, with young and old, to force the issue of people facing the reality of this unprecedented crisis we're in. And in particular, I'm hoping, I think Stuart's going to be discussing the expose that the LaRouche Political Action Committee and the LaRouche Youth Movement are leading, to show that there's been an intense subversion operation of our elections in the United States and of other institutional functioning by people associated with the name, well, the people behind this name, George Soros, your enemy George Soros. So we'll get to that in a minute. But John, you could start anywhere you like, but one thing I know you've written in the last 48 hours is that the system is dead and we can save the nation and even deserving banks. But why don't you start with any of that you would like to?
Well, I think the question of a deserving bank that sort of gets to the heart of what we're talking about, because what we're talking about when we say, you know, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, we're not really talking about saving particular institutions as much as we are talking about saving necessary banking functions. That the whole banking system has been taken over by parasites. That it's all, you know, if you look at the especially the bigger the bank is, the more involved it is in speculation. All of the really big banks, the Citigroup, the J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, these things are so far down the road of being speculators as opposed to banks that that there's not really a lot there to save, except that they still make loans, you still have checking accounts and that sort of thing. So that the sort of functions that are necessary to provide the credit for an economy to function is what we're talking about when we're talking about saving the banks. We're not talking about bailing them out of their multi-quadrillion dollar derivative portfolios or anything like that. And this is all important because basically this whole system has come crashing down. That the banking system was functioning on the basis of making loans that were basically ridiculous loans, loaning money to people who were so loaded with debt already that they'd never be able to pay the debt back, and you keep rolling over these loans. And the securities machine, the mortgage-backed securities and other asset-backed securities, credit card-backed securities, all sorts of things, this whole system was used to keep rolling over these loans, that the banks would make these loans and then sell them off to investors, with quotation marks around that, because they're actually speculators, most of them. And this is the nature of the system, but that securities machine has now died. And because the banks are no longer able to make money, the speculators are no longer able to make money speculating in the securities market, they've moved to where they can make money speculating, the things that people are still buying, which is food and energy. And this has caused the soaring of prices of oil and all sorts of food products. So the system is spinning, it's spinning completely out of control. That in order to save the banking system, to keep these banks afloat, they need to continually increase the amount of money that they're looting through oil and food and other types of speculation. And they're getting enormous subsidies from the federal government to stay open. But at the same time, you know, as we've all been told, we have a consumer-driven economy. And the higher gasoline prices go and the higher food prices go, the fewer things that people can buy. And at the same time, you've got, since the debt machine, the securities machine has crashed, that the banks are cutting back on credit limits. Credit card limits and things like that are being cut down. So you have this situation where you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You need to keep the speculation going in order to keep the banking system afloat, to provide the money for it. But if you do that, it blows out the consumer end of the economy, blows out all the households and a lot of the businesses. But if you stop the speculation in order to protect that, then you don't have the funds to keep the banking system going. And that's the dilemma. And so, you know, that's why we need the LaRouche's three-part program, beginning with the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act, which just freezes all of this and puts the system through bankruptcy and protects people while we work out this disaster that the bankers have created.
Could you reiterate, too, I mean, this is the front line, the firewall, you could call it, and so forth, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, but you mentioned 3 points, and just reiterate those if you don't mind.
Sure. The first point, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, you're going to have to put the system through bankruptcy. And so the first thing you do is you erect firewalls. You freeze things so that, for example, people who are dependent upon pensions, and many of the pensions pension funds invested in worthless paper. A lot of this stuff is just going to get written off. For example, food moving from farms. The farms need to continue to operate. The food needs to be transported to the grocery stores, that sort of thing. The hospitals have to keep working. The schools have to stay open. The you know, emergency services, the, you know, the sort of things that the real economy has to continue to function because people's lives depend upon it. So you have to set up a mechanism whereby even while you're freezing and writing off these trillions, quadrillions of dollars worth of worthless assets, that you protect ordinary citizens. So that's what the firewall and the HBPA is designed to do. And then the second step is that you begin, once you've frozen all that and have stopped the collapse, stopped this speculative frenzy, stopped this hyperinflationary blowout that we're in the middle of right now, then you can begin to rebuild. And you do that with a two-tiered credit system, whereby you have projects which are designed to increase the productive power of human labor. Infrastructure projects, do something about our, you know, our roads, our transportation grid, the energy grid, the collapsing water and sewer systems, all the sorts of things that are necessary to get the economy to, you know, to get the economy moving again. Taking care of, you know, we need to go to nuclear power, and we have all sorts of needs like that. Great projects like the Nawapa water system. So you need a credit system which will provide low-interest credit for these kinds of necessary projects, the projects that are necessary to get the country moving again. And at the same time, then, for all other functions, you have a higher interest rate. So let's say you make loans for these development projects at 1% to 2% interest rate. And then for other things, then you have, you know, a higher interest rate, you know, 6% or 7%, something like that. So that's the two-tiered credit system, to make sure that the money flows into the most essential projects and it flows into a credit rate that allows those things to continue. And then the third phase of this is the Four Powers Agreement. That the idea is that the United States has to work with Russia, China, and India, among other nations. But those are the big four that have the political power to put this financial system through bankruptcy and put the empires back in its cage and begin rebuilding the world. And so you need all three of those elements. That first you have to stop the damage, and then you have to begin a process of some serious rebuilding, both nationally in the United States and internationally. You can't just cut nations off. You can't let nations die.
Well, let me turn to Stuart here, who's out in Seattle, because there are many more questions, John, before the hour is over. We want to you to address here, including the status of the behind the scenes or in public warfare among different factions of this dead system and what they're doing. But Stuart, you've been involved in direct organizing within the Democratic Party and at large about different aspects of the degree of this crisis, the need for a firewall, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. Why don't you, do you want to start by saying what the response is, that it's more than it was, say, 6 months ago or 3 months ago, in the people facing the reality?
Yeah, sure. So this, as John was talking about, we're clearly entering a further and further decline of this financial system, which is having direct effects on, you know, daily more and more of direct effects on the population. And so it's getting to the point now where the same people that maybe 6 months ago, or some even a little bit longer, would say, "Oh, everything is fine. I don't mind it at all. It's just, this is just a little dip in the markets." Now are saying, "What is going on? Tell me what's happening," with this kind of a desperation to know what's going on and a certain amount of how to fix it. Now, the biggest thing that we're running into is I want to call it a certain amount of apathy, but there's a line that you get constantly with especially the lower 80% and also students, young people, where they'll say, they'll admit that we may be right, that LaRouche may have known all along what's going on, and that yes, in fact, the whole system is in a systemic collapse, but I can't do anything about it. And so this is a constant line, which is more what we've been trying to pinpoint and flank as a youth movement, and I think even broader, that's what Mr. LaRouche is looking at. But so our job and what we've been working towards, especially with some of the Democratic Party circles and Hillary Clinton supporters, is how to get the majority of the population to really recognize historically what this problem is and what the cause of it is, what a financial empire really looks like.
Well, that brings in some of the bad guys, right?
Yeah, that's why we're getting out this dossier on George Soros, and so we're really going directly after the people that are creating this problem and are creating the agenda for the Democratic Party and the different, you know, what so-called leaders, to make sure that there are no real solutions put on the table.
Yeah, let me throw in here, anyone listening live or by phone, and you know we welcome emails. This is www.larouchepub.com. But I recommend that everyone get your hands on this and get it out, what you just mentioned, this dossier on George Soros, your enemy George Soros. And you can get that on the Political Action Committee, www.larouchepac.com. There are thousands printed. It's in the process of having a couple hundred thousand printed. Do you have a hard copy out there in circulation in Seattle, Stuart?
Yes, we do.
So why don't you continue on that about the... this was written by the LaRouche Youth Movement, a whole team and a team of researchers. What's been the response?
Well, to tell you the truth, we just got it yesterday afternoon.
Okay.
So yesterday was the first day out with it, which was we've clearly been in with high anticipation for it. So, but the response is so far is that it's kind of what I just mentioned is there's this certain amount of panic setting in among the population generally about what's happening and why this is happening. And so with our attack on this guy's political career, it's really opening up the doors for people to understand what in fact an operation of this British operation is. It's not just this magical sense of there's these corrupt people that have a lot of money and they're somewhere else. They're somewhere in a place where I'm not sure where it exists. But it's really putting a name and a face on what's occurring with the breakdown of the physical economy generally. So one of the more significant things that I want to bring up is that we had the Washington State Democratic Convention two weekends ago, and we went there, of course, with the expectation to stir up, especially the Hillary Clinton supporters, but as well as the majority, all the Democrats that were there. But what we found when we got there is that the whole party was oriented around a unity kind of idea. So any talk of a secondary candidate other than Barack Obama was out of the picture. So we found in the convention itself speeches by senators, by the mayor of Seattle was there, and by different leaders of the state party that were nixing the idea of Hillary Clinton and her ideas as a potential candidate, and more forcing these 18 million supporters of hers across the country into the standard Democratic line. So a lot of people were demoralized, and we ran into this kind of a frenzy and disarray and confusion that was very obvious, intentional. These people that have fought harder, much, much harder than anybody that we have really run into. There was a very driven campaign here, have now been turned around, and there's very clearly the Democratic Party has been trying to get these 18 million supporters to just forget about the whole reason they were fighting for a Franklin Roosevelt idea.
All right, but since then in the aftermath of that, on the in Seattle and so forth, though, you're collaborating and regrouping these people to fight on. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, we've been following up with a lot of these groups, and we found that really the people that we met at the convention and others that we've been meeting around are ready to go, essentially, with people that are taking up just whatever they can do in terms of how to organize communities, how to organize different circles of anyone that they can find. And the reason that we've found is that they have the best sense out of anybody, even the people that know there's something fishy going on with the economy. The Hillary Clinton circles that we met with the convention and afterwards have a very very sharp understanding that there is a political operation being run. So when we brought out this George Soros pamphlet in the recent weeks and days, there's been this astounding response where people are, for us we just got it yesterday, so people were avidly looking at our website previous to that to see this dossier, and because when we bring up the idea of a financial empire that's literally funding the Democratic Party and Howard Dean and Obama's campaign to make sure that the real issues are taken off the table, the response is dramatic. So it's really exciting to be able to try to get essentially to get the population out of the realm of these little events that are seemingly happening, and more oriented around what historically the context is of the operation going on today.
Well, I think it's really black and white, as you're saying. I understand that. The use of this Obama operation, let's call it that. I understand this week there was a closed-door economics Obama campaign meeting that no one was allowed to attend, that other than the organizers in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon Institute, where I understand the gist of it was that the Obama platform is to extol such things as how Pittsburgh is no longer a steel city at all, not a manufacturing city, has switched over to a service industry. And if anyone has been around all the major towns of what used to be the Pittsburgh industrial powerhouse, Clairton, McKeesport, Duquesne, Homestead, they are in shambles. They are in terrible, terrible, depressed conditions, falling apart. And this is supposed to be how wonderful it is. So it seems to me it's really open season, just like you're saying, for us to intervene and regroup. But, John, what about the – you followed George Soros for the last 150 years, I think. Why don't you throw in something here about what makes him – who he is, what makes him so useful? I'm not asking any – people should go and get this dossier, as Stuart just said, and contribute resources and circulate it. But the people behind George Soros, as well as the man himself. Say something, John.
Well, the thing about George Soros is that he is both an influential person in the Democratic Party. He's a controller of the Democratic Party because he has a lot of money to spread around. But he personally is basically a stooge. You know, he's this vaunted investor who makes all these brilliant decisions and understands the markets, and you know, it's all a bunch of nonsense because basically he's a creature of the British financiers. That his money comes through the Rothschild dirty money operation, and the Rothschilds, you know, they made their fortune working for the Venetians. You know, this is, so he's funded. He's a fund manager, but he doesn't even manage the money. Basically, they use him as a conduit to spread money around. They use him as a conduit to speculation. So they basically bought up a lot of the leadership of the Democratic Party. And so we go after Soros as, you know, sort of the lead duck principle that you know that he is not the problem in and of himself. He's a representative of the problem, but he's a tool, and so you break their tool, and then you go after them. But he's, a fund manager, and a fund manager, the powers behind him are the people who give him the money. It's not his money, and he doesn't really manage it. People manage it for him. So he's sort of a front man. I like to call him sort of the Donald Trump of the hedge fund world. And, you know, so that's essentially what he is. And basically what has happened is that you have this, with the creation of the oil hoaxes and the petrodollar market, the spot market in oil in the 70s, you've created this huge pool of what are called petrodollars in Europe that are used by the financiers of this Anglo-Dutch liberal system to buy up the United States. They've used this to help spur deregulation and globalization, you know, help. This is the process which has helped move our jobs overseas, you know, and to make the United States, the idea is to make every nation dependent upon these global cartels for the means of their existence. And that is what Soros has been doing, and his political operations are running cover for that by, you know, is trying to create so-called free markets, which is more market manipulation in countries around the world, he spends lots of money to make sure that nobody in the leadership of the Democratic Party, people like Nancy Pelosi, for example, will do anything about this speculation, which is killing us. So, you know, George Soros has to go, but we should never be deluded into thinking that just because we get rid of him, we've solved the problem. So we need to get rid of him as the first step of solving the problem, but then we have to follow through and go after the people who are really calling the shots, and that's this financier oligarchy centered in the City of London.
Right. Well, Stuart, in other words, what John, we're saying here that isn't just a miasma of general greed, but there's a British pedigree, a London pedigree, there's specific characters like George Soros that are deployed, they have a whole history of this. How does this sit with some of the people you said you've been meeting with? Is it aha that they wondered who and how this is being done, or disbelief, or, you know, the people that you said are, yeah, the 18 million voices. What? Or there was a thing called Right Party Unity, my ass, if I can say that.
There was. There was there is still.
Okay.
There's quite the fight going on with some of the people we've been meeting with and have been seeing emerge towards this. The figure of George Soros is very well known among the Democratic Party. So when you bring it up, there is a lot of that aha kind of effect where people say, I knew it. That's where they're getting all their money from. And at the same time, this guy's making all this money off of the different financial markets and speculation that is just unchecked. And so I was going to ask you, John, if you had more of an insight and you could help me and some others understand exactly how a guy like Soros and others that really are able to pull these little tricks and operations against something like the Democratic Party.
Well, the way that they're able to pull it is that they're not really pulling it themselves. They're merely sort of the public face of something much bigger. That through his whole career, for example, his famous case where he was involved in this 1992 raid on the British pound, in which he became known as the man who broke the Bank of England. Right. Well, that operation of which he was a part was actually orchestrated by the Bank of England. I mean, the proof that George Soros didn't break the Bank of England is that George Soros is still alive. Because if he had gone after the Bank of England the way that they said, he'd be dead. Because they don't tolerate that sort of thing. You know, the British have a long history of killing people who do things like that.
And, John, could you mention, I mean, some people don't go back far enough. I do, of course. But just that, you know, several day, several hour period when he apparently was this lone speculator. Could you just mention the characteristics of what that episode was?
Well, the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, which is kind of a mouthful to say, but it was a currency band where, as part of the beginnings of the unification of Europe, which we now see is taking place with the Euro and the Lisbon Treaty, where the currencies of Europe would trade against each other, there would be bands established. So, the pound could go no higher than this or no lower than this against the Deutschmark. And this was set up by this financier oligarchy as a way of implementing a sort of this United States of Europe, although it's more of a it's an assault on the nations of Europe by setting up sort of a regional government. And so the Brits helped set this up. But then they decided that they wanted out of it. They didn't really want the pound to be in it. They put it in it originally to get this thing moving, and then they decided they wanted the pound out. And at the same time that this was going on in 1992, the number of major Western banks were bankrupt. And so what happened is that the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve and banks allied with them launched this currency speculation attack on other European currencies and on the pound itself. And because of their enormous market power, the amount of money that they could throw at these things, they were able to drive the lira out. They made a bundle on that. They were able to pull the pound out of this European exchange rate mechanism. And, you know, it was extremely profitable. Citicorp, as it was known at the time, and it was being run by the Federal Reserve directly at the time, made about $1 billion out of that. J.P. Morgan made a similar amount, and other banks made lots of money, and Soros made money, and Soros wasn't the only one, but he was the one that they put up as the public face of this, because you never want the central banks to be caught doing that kind of criminal manipulation themselves. So you use a guy like Soros as a front man. But he wasn't the one doing it. He was in on it, but he was not the power behind it. And so if you look at the manipulation of the Democratic Party, well, we have a big British problem in the United States. We've always had one. And there are a lot of Anglophiles, a lot of people who consider Britain, who identify with this British Anglo-Dutch financial model, the speculators, and who want to see that take over the United States and don't want to see a country run by ordinary people. They want to reshape the United States and sort of along the British line, where you have the, you know, more of a class society, and the very rich live very well and everyone else is just sort of left to fend for themselves, you know. Or what it really is it's a lord and peasants model. And so they use their political power in the United States. They use the money that they get from all of their financial operations to buy lots of influence. And they use Soros as a point man for this. But they also have, you know, they have lots of other things. They have a big media operation. You know, you have sort of Fox News on the right pushing pushing their brand of fascism, but then you have this sort of liberal imperialist crowd around things like the New York Times, which pushes the same thing. So there's a it's a much bigger operation, but you put the sort of the face of one man on it. You conduit a lot of this power through this one guy. And so then it looks like he's the one doing it all. And you think, so you ask the question, how can one guy do all of this, you know? And the answer is that the case is he's not. It's not really him. He's just the agent for this.
Right. Well, let me ask you back on the collapse process. And we started the show by talking about the end of the second quarter. And just looking at the headlines in the last 48 hours, you see losses or announcements of what has to be sold off by certain banks. I don't know who's supposed to buy it. I mean, in other words, you see skirmishing, you see that kind of thing. So, John, what about this moment in this collapse? What we're getting a lot of fairy stories if you watch MSNBC or turn on one of these media outlets that you just said are part of the operation here, saying, oh, this or that can happen, or smaller banks will be bought by larger banks. But it really seems like it's just a bedlam.
It is, because what we have here is a classic banking crisis, that the real estate, the myth is that this was driven by real estate, that the subprime market collapsed, and then that set off a chain of dominoes which has now reached the banking system. And that's a fraud, because it was a banking crisis all along, and it was the need for the banking system for money which was driving the appreciation of real estate prices. And they drove it up so high that the whole thing blew up. But right now you've reached the point where the banks are insolvent. And they've got a real problem. Over the past year or so, they've written off some $400 billion in taken in losses. And that's only the beginning of what's coming down the pike. They've also been raising capital like crazy. They've raised, over $300 billion in capital by selling additional stock and things like that. And the central banks have loaned the banking system an extraordinary amount. They put out over $3.6 trillion in loans over the past year, year and a half, since this crisis began. And despite the amount of money, no matter how much money they pour into it, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what the losses are. The system is vaporizing. That you have this, when you had this securities machine going full force and everybody was trading in CDOs and all of this other alphabet soup of nonsense, basically worthless paper back and forth. Well, that market is gone. And so you have this huge financial superstructure, all of these commercial banks, investment banks, hedge funds, and other things, which grew up around this bubble. And now that this bubble has popped and the volume of business has shrunk dramatically, then not only is there no more need for all of these banks, there's no more business to keep them all going. So this whole system is being dramatically downsized by reality. And the bankers are trying to manage this collapse by all sorts of methods. But they're responding to events. They're not really in control of anything. And now we've reached the point where, as we were talking before, that you can either bail them out through all this speculation and blow up the consumer side, which blows up the banks, or you can stop the speculation in order to protect the consumer side. That's going to blow up the banks. That these things are going, and what we're beginning to see is signs that some factions are getting, basically declaring open warfare on others. You have, for example, the British connected press like Rupert Murdoch, his Wall Street Journal, and certain British connected financial institutions have been launching assaults, mainly political assaults, having their analysts attack lots of newspaper articles, going after banks like Citigroup. They praised J.P. Morgan Chase, which was actually formed in Britain, comes out of Britain. The old Morgan banking empire was British in origin. And so they praise their own, the ones that they control, and the ones that they don't control so much, they're now attacking. So you see Citigroup under attack, Union Bank of Switzerland, UBS under attack. You had this incident where Société Générale of France was under attack. You know, the system is actually breaking apart, and we're getting more and more warfare among the various players as they fight. You know, the dynamic is sort of like a pack of wolves. When there's not enough, and they'll all work together to bring down the prey, but then if there's not enough to eat, they start fighting among themselves. And if necessary, you know, they drive out or kill the weaker members of the pack so that there's enough for the rest of them to eat. And that's kind of the dynamic is beginning to take shape in the financial system right now. And when this happens, then the consensus completely breaks down. So I think we're going to see some dramatic developments. I mean, there are, for example, you know, Lehman Brothers is probably the next major investment bank to go because they were heavily involved in all of this real estate speculation. And among major commercial banks, bank holding companies, Wachovia is in real trouble right now. There are rumors that it will fail, rumors that it's going to be bailed out via merger by J.P. Morgan Chase. You know, which is one bankrupt institution rescuing another. But every time they pull one of these rescue operations, or every time they, you know, put more money into the bank through the Fed, you know, all they're doing is creating more debt. And the problem is that we have a huge debt overhead that can't be paid. And you cannot solve a debt crisis by creating more debt. So this whole thing is coming down.
Let me ask you, and one subset of this among these wolves, it seems that there's been some spectacular headlines about hot money, including George Soros, buying into the food chain to literally own parts of food processing, merchandising. ConAgra is selling its, that's a very, one of the big food processing operations along with Cargill, ADM, Bunge. They're selling part of their units to a George Soros-connected consortium. And in other meat in Europe, this kind of thing. Is that part of the picture?
It is part of the picture. I mean, you've written a lot about what's going on with the food crisis and the cartelization, and everything is being cartelized. This is what globalization really is. It's the cartelization of everything in which, you know, everybody is going to be dependent upon these cartels for the necessities of life. So they're taking over food. They're taking over raw materials. They're taking over finance. They're taking over everything. And this is all going on. The world is being restructured right before our eyes. And meanwhile, you know, we have our politicians sitting around twiddling their thumbs or doing something even worse with their thumbs, you know, while they're getting paid off by people like George Soros. And so, you know, we've got to stop this, and we've got to start implementing LaRouche's plan, or we're going to see something that most of us thought they would never see in their lifetime, something much worse than the Great Depression, because we're in a breakdown crisis. It's not just a depression. It's not a cyclical problem. Our society is breaking apart at this point, and if we don't do something quickly, there's not going to be anything there to hold it together.
Now, I was going to input that from what we've been getting in the youth movement is that constituents from all across the country are now starting to just hone in and grill their political leaders for their constituencies, and so it seems, so this is exactly the trend that you were speaking about, John, is that as this is coming down, there's more and more of an awareness by people that this is not going to end well for them if it continues in this direction.
Yes,
and
sure.
So is where LaRouche's ideas are the only solution to this kind of breakdown that we need to get our populations demanding.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, people, you can't ignore this. There's no one who can pretend that this isn't going on. Every time you go to the grocery store or the gas station, you know, you feel like you're getting raped. And no one's doing anything about it. We're being told that this is actually good for us. You know, our politicians, you know, you look at the Democratic leadership. When the Democratic Party took control of Congress, and everybody had high hopes they would do something good. And basically they seem to have been, you know, stooges for the Republican Party. They've been going along with all of the things that the Bush administration is doing. And that's because both parties at the top are basically controlled by the same people and the same money. And, you know, people get this. It's obvious that no one is doing anything and that people are demanding that changes be made. You know, and basically, I think that what they're doing in putting the politicians' feet to the fire is a very useful thing, because the politicians have to be more afraid of what happens to them when they come home than they are of George Soros, if we're going to get anywhere.
Well, that seems to be building up. Let me ask you one thing, Stuart or John, if you want to chime in on this, about what you're raising, the people's reaction 6 months ago. I mean, the general population, but the lower 80% of people who've been involved in the economy and not any high rollers, they might have flipped things off 6 months ago, but no one's flipping anything off now that has to actually buy food and get around and live. But there are different parts of the country. There's different uptake to also the kind of projects, John, you were describing before, or the FDR approach to life in the 1930s, where people went out and built, or Harry Hopkins developed 3 million jobs in only a 3-month period. They built big things, they built small things. But so, for example, I know in Texas and Southern California, when it's put out there that we should have these cross-border water projects with Mexico, that our LaRouche Youth Movement organizers, Keisha Rogers, who ran for Democratic Party chair in Texas, was saying, I was talking to her yesterday, that, but, you know, you get people who make the connection. We ought to be doing things. What about Washington State or the Pacific Northwest? In recent years, some of the operatives in the Democratic Party trying to subvert our country would try and have the Northwest be the kind of environmental madhouse of the country.
Yeah.
But leave that aside. What do people respond to that they, is it straight and that's fair enough, oil and gas and food? Or do they have something that characterizes that region of what they think ought to be built? And I'm just asking that if you happen to go into, for example, a railroad connection up through Oregon and Washington to British Columbia to Alaska to Russia, when youth or anyone hear about it, that's one that should have been built 80 years ago.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a funny region. We've got, I'd say, more people with moss growing in their beards than any other place in the world. So
that's insanitary, I think.
that's what we say. You're right. The environmentalism up here is pretty astounding. There was a big vote recently. It was last November for a very broad-reaching light rail transit link up from, I believe it was from south, some cities south of Seattle up through and kind of around the area, which was voted down. So it's kind of a pushy topic up here that we've actually done a good job breaking through it, But then in other parts, I mean, this is you know, there's sometimes a different population that we run into at the voting polls and at certain urban areas of Seattle. But then opposed to that, which we've been running into, especially in some of the rural and smaller communities, especially immigrant communities in the outlying areas of Seattle, where we've had resounding excitement about these ideas of infrastructure. And so one example was, we've been we've been working in a small city south of Seattle for a while, which has a very large immigrant Somalian community. And so one of the particular people we've run into has taken a whole bunch of extra literature, especially that on this Homeowners and Bank Protection Act and LaRouche's three steps. And we visited him just earlier this week, and he said that he has been talking to people and has gotten a lot of people that are very excited about these infrastructure projects. And that's what he has been discussing with people, is the idea of these projects. So it really is what gives people that tangible idea of how it is that we need to be rebuilding the country and also the world.
Well, besides all the skills base that you had in the greater Seattle region in the past with Boeing aircraft and then the port and everything, you were also a major agriculture region of the country with, I think, the Grand Coulee Dam and wheat. I don't know if you've been in Olympia a lot or this also is that you run into the anyone in the state associated with these features of your economic base. Is that or not?
Yeah, we that's true. Now, I don't know a ton about it, so I couldn't tell you all that's going on with these people. But we, you bring up the large parts of the agriculture, which is mostly in central and eastern Washington.
Right.
So we ran into a lot of this when we went to the state convention in Spokane a couple weeks ago. And so. So you get these farming communities which are mostly have a very good sense that this environmentalist garbage that's coming out is calling for biofuels and calling for less water irrigation and more protection of the ecosystem is just a bunch of bull. So there is a very strong sentiment around that with these farming communities, but then you get, there's also, like we talked about a minute ago, there's a lot of people that are in this organic days, and so you run into the small farmers and small communities that are pro free market, pro WTO, and pro these kind of small organic communities.
Right. Well, of course, that's, John, that's where some of the media and other behind-the-scenes operations have been going on for decades, right, to confuse everyone and spread superstition. And the Soros colleagues, not to mention Al Gore, Bill Gates, and so forth. But do you want to say anything more in the closing minutes of the show about anything associated with the, you used this expression, the world financial system is already dead. There are rotten parts of it just hiving off, falling off like a decomposing corpse. Is there anything to be described about the situation or that sums it up?
Well, I think that pretty well sums it up. But the thing is that it's accelerating. It's getting worse. This is not a linear process. We're in a death spiral, basically, because all of these pieces of this dead system. When the system dies, then all of the pieces of the system start to die too. And the smaller this system gets, even though it's using leverage and it's creating huge amounts of debt in its death throes. It's sort of like a supernova. In that respect, there is no way that it's coming back. The real issue is what kind of a system is going to replace it. And if you look at what people like George Soros are proposing, this idea of this modern cartel world, sort of a return to the days of the British East India Company with the added benefits of this high technology of Big Brother, is where they're headed. And so what we have to do is we have to go back to the American system. We have to make sure that we reorganize this thing our way and protect the people. Because if we don't, hell is going to break loose.
Well, it's funny. You've got an email, John, from Santiago, who's a regular emailer here. Thank you, Santiago. But he, I'll just read one part of it. He said, given how long it's taking for the U.S. population, let alone U.S. politicos, to awaken reality, he says, Santiago says, then please tell me that there is a something happening among a group of sovereign nations that are trying to initiate this. I don't know if you can say that, John, or Stuart can say it. I think it's just what you said. We have the big fight, the big fulcrum is here in the United States, right?
Yeah, it is. But there, I mean, you know, I share Santiago's concerns because it has. We have to do this. It's not enough to talk about it. But you can see movement in Russia, in China, in India, in other nations that realize that they're on the chopping block. And the real nut to crack is the United States, to get us to support this kind of a program instead of doing what, you know, the Bush administration would do, which is try to destroy it. And this support is growing. You know, we just have to make sure that it grows fast enough in order to turn this thing around. It's an uphill fight, but we've got a shot at it.
Right, and Stuart, you've been among the people you've been working with in recent days after that Washington State Convention. There is a certain momentum, right? To go into Denver, that would be the Democratic Party State Convention, right? National Convention.
Right.
And make an issue. How would you characterize it? There is a inclination to make an issue of the FDR sense in the country today, instead of just roll over for these dirty operations.
Oh yeah, yeah. There is clearly a very large movement that is massively growing to lift up. It's been more so characterized with the Hillary Clinton supporters, the FDR, the mentality of a Franklin Roosevelt and that kind of program. But there is really an effort to lift up the people that are willing to fight and want to do something like this across the country. I know that one of these groups that's recently been formed, I believe the headquarters is in New York now, but they are attempting to organize for a million person march in Denver during the convention. So this race, believe it or not, is not over by any means. If you look at what some of these organizations are starting up, there's a massive grassroots movement.
Right, and so we still have a few seconds, but let me reiterate again, July 22nd is an International LaRouche webcast at 1 p.m. that day, and you can look for that on the Political Action Committee, www.larouchepac.com. And Stuart, then, by the way, I also want to say July 5th, listen to the 4th of July weekend for this show. It will be from 3 to 4 as it is every week Eastern Time on LaRouchePub.com. Harley Schlanger will be the host, and we may have, I'm sure we have something major packed on that one. We have one more email I'd like to throw out here to John, because Fred Unifeld sends greetings from Louisiana, and he just wants you to address in the final seconds about the prospect for fixed exchange rates again between nations. This is something that you could see happening?
Yes. I mean, the issue is that, you know, despite all of the great power that these bankers have, their system has died, and they're dying. And so you're going to have a new system. And everybody who looks at this knows that what we've done has been a complete disaster and that we have to do something differently. So there's a big fight brewing, and this thing can actually coalesce very quickly under the right circumstances. So I think, yeah, we have a very good chance that we'll go back to this fixed exchange rate. We'll get this four-power agreement. We can get people working. You know, we can pull this thing off because it will be increasingly obvious that this thing is coming down.
Well, that's great. I think we've used up our time. I want to thank Stuart Battle in the LaRouche Youth Movement in the Seattle office. Thank you, Stuart, for being here.
Sure.
And John Hofel, who's near our studio here in Virginia. And I also want to say, everyone, look on the websites of the LaRouche Political Action Committee. I hear they have dynamite new expose of these George Soros open society filthy networks being behind what's going on in trying to destroy Zimbabwe. And this is just something in the last 24 hours that's been put together, and it shows the power of the kind of thing that we can change day by day. And so I thank you all for listening. This is Marcia Mary Baker. We're signing off the LaRouche Show, June 28th, 2008. Thank you, everyone.